Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experience within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I'm here today with Greg Lanier. Greg joined the faculty of RTS. If you're not familiar with RTS, it's Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando in 2016 and teaches courses related to New Testament exegesis. You may have to explain that one for our listeners. And interpretation, Greek, and preaching. He is also an associate pastor, which is part-time, at River Oaks Church. Before moving to Florida, the Laniers lived in Cambridge, England. That must be interesting, where Greg finished his doctorate. Prior to their overseas, Greg worked in various professional roles in Charlotte, Birmingham, and Atlanta, ranging from management consulting to private equity investing. So I didn't realize private equity investing. So this will be great because a lot of private equity investors would be listening here. So Greg, thanks. I appreciate your time and looking forward to hear from you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great. Great to be here.
Before we get started, tell us, jump in real fast. What are we doing in private equity?
I worked for about 3 years for a kind of lower middle market private fund. At the time, it was called Copley Capital, and it's evolved since then. The main form now is Zabel Companies, and it was in Charlotte. It was a great time. There were two principal guys behind the fund and a handful of us associates. And yeah, so I was traveling all over the place, kicking the tires of sausage companies and extended long range drilling corporations. It's an interesting time.
Give us a little background of yourself, where you grew up, maybe went to school, where you went to school, and then just a high level of your career.
It's a bit unusual that I'm in the role that I'm in now. Certainly didn't see it coming a decade ago, but I grew up in a small town in the middle of North Carolina. My parents were school teachers, and I ended up at UNC Chapel Hill. I studied computer science back before it was cool. And in fact, I studied computer science back when it was profoundly uncool during the dot-com bust. And we were like the most hated people on campus. It was kind of early days, you know, Google was just becoming a thing and there was no Facebook. You know, we were on instant messenger back then. I minored in business. Right out of that, I went and worked for the Boston Consulting Group in Atlanta, which was a demanding job, as you know, mm-hmm. but it was actually a great, great time. And I couldn't imagine a better introduction to business than working for them or companies like them. And consulted with Delta Airlines and a bunch of other companies like that. When I got married, I moved to Birmingham, worked for Regions Financial during their integration with AmSouth, which was a strangely acrimonious. I was telling my kids about that. I was like, imagine your two school rivals trying to merge together and everybody hates each other. That's basically what I did. And so that was my Birmingham time. And then it was right after that I started working for the private equity firm. So about 7-8 years into business, discerned a call into vocational ministry and pursued I had actually just taken the GMAT, was going to go to business school and change directions, ended up going to theological school. And then from there to England to do the PhD and then got the job here in Orlando. So that's kind of the short version. So it's kind of an interesting path in that a lot of the things I did, especially consulting and investing, you know, meeting people, analyzing data, presenting information, it dovetailed quite nicely into ministry preparation. Like most of what I learned in terms of speaking and even in some sense, sermon prep, I kind of cut my teeth on that in consulting because that's really what consulting is, analyzing data and coming up with a compelling way to present it to produce change. And so it's kind of a funny way that I ended up in this position now, because a lot of what I did at the time, I didn't make any sense. But now it's like, oh, I can see how that was.
So what was the impetus for you saying, I'm leaving the business world, going into ministry?
Yeah, I wasn't unhappy in the business world, although it was a very bad time to be in private equity. This is 2008, 2009, 2010.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I think I looked at over 300 deals and we didn't close a single one in that time frame just because the market was awful. I mean, they're doing quite well now, but it couldn't have been a worse time. I mean, didn't know it going into it. I was content in business, but through a variety of people, like who are influences in my life at the time, particularly the church where I was involved in Charlotte, where I was working. They were saying, hey, you have some gifts in terms of ministering to people, and why don't you test those out? So I actually took some night classes and was cutting my teeth in various things in the church environment. And decided to make the move. So it was a long process, actually. It's kind of a long story versus it wasn't a big like epiphany moment. It was
Got
kind
it.
of a process more than anything. So blessing of it, and I see this a lot, especially with my students now who don't have that background. They just go from like private school to Bible college to
Right.
ministry, which is fine. That's certainly obviously a viable path. But for me, I really appreciate having the exposure of getting on planes week in and week out, being in boardroom meetings, having the stress of deliverables and trying to meet objectives, because that's the people I'm ministering to now. And so I understand what they go through, and because I've been there. And so I've grown to really appreciate, even though it didn't make sense at the time in some respects, but I've grown to appreciate, oh yeah, I totally get that. Like I'm not in the boardroom now, but I've been there, and I know what it's like, and to make
So
the connection.
today you are what, a pastor? Is that a part-time pastor? And then you are teaching. Give us just a little bit of teaching at RTS. Give us just a little overview of that.
Sure, yeah. So Reformed Theological Seminary is a graduate program. So it's not, we don't do undergraduate degree, and it's a 2 to 4 year graduate program designed to equip people to go into ministry, typically to train pastors, but also we have a counseling program. We have various sort of shorter programs that could be for people who are going into the mission field or nonprofit sector. And so that's my day job, and I'm a New Testament prof there. And my side hustle, if you will, my nights and weekends is as a pastor at a local church. And so I do a whole variety of things. I'm kind of the quasi-executive pastor for that role. So I do a lot of our IT and systems back end, and then I preach a fair amount and do a lot of the teaching. But I also I'm kind of the, because of my background in business and computer science, I'm the wizard behind the curtain, if you will,
Yeah,
there.
I gotta believe that maybe I'm maybe I've got a stereotype in my head, but I don't picture the typical pastor having your background or your career path.
It is a little unusual. And in fact, if there's one class I could teach at the seminary that we don't offer, it would be teaching these men and women how the business world works, especially in terms of like how a budget and a P&L for a church and the legal situation, all that, and how to run a church. Because it's not something we teach well. And it's a lot of things, it's areas that a lot of pastors don't understand. Like they don't know, they've never seen a balance sheet. And so that's a really an unfortunate, and they get there if they have good deacons or what have you, they can get there. But yeah, it's a big gap in our curriculum for sure.
So for our listeners, I heard Greg speak at a group called the National Christian Foundation, which is a donor advised fund. And so after hearing that conversation, I said, this would be fascinating to have you on just to share for a couple of reasons. Number one, so currently I am in it's a faith-based cohort of there's probably 15, 20 of us under what's called the GIN, the Global Impact Investor Network. And so they've assembled 15, 20 of us under this faith umbrella, which is quite broad. There's all different types of faith, really, to look at this idea around racial equity. So that's kind of one thing. But the second thing is that I don't know that most people realize that impact investing, or depending on how you want to classify what you call that, but this idea of making money, aligning with your values, doing good, actually started in the faith community. So having you on today is quite interesting, because with inside the community, there is a generally accepted notion and idea that faith can be a part of it. As we start to bring people under the tent who are not of faith mindset, it's sometimes a little bit like, well, why are they in the room? And you go, well, no, this is actually how it started out. So, which is a shock to most. So, just a high level preface. Let me ask you, I'm going to start off with a big question. How would you best describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
Well, my journey has been so strange in certain respects with a major pivot point. I was on the business path from the very beginning, and I was doing well. And my wife married me at the perfect time, at the peak of my earnings potential. It was well played on her part. It's been a downhill path ever since. Whenever I went and did the PhD, one of the things that was a compelling motivation for me is to try to bridge the world of academics and the world of kind of what we would call, laypersons. And I think I'm still trying to do that, sort of how can I leverage scholarship and those kind of the nerdy side of things, if you will, and bless the people in my local church or through research and writing, people out there who read books and that kind of thing. So I that's probably a big impetus, is how do I do that? And then for my students, you know, I'm just essentially what motivates us at RTS, at least, is we are trying to train the next generation of people who on campuses and in churches and so on will be taking care of our kids and grandkids. I am teaching a class on counseling right now. I'm like, you are going to be counseling, you know, my kids, and, you know, mental health obviously being a huge thing. That it's a stewardship, really, to invest in the next generation of, it's really a multiplying, it's kind of interesting capital idea. You know, I could go and be a pastor of a church of a few hundred people, and I do that, but that's one way to have an impact. Another way is to actually teach the pastors and the counselors and the missionaries and so forth of hundreds of churches who have hundreds of people. And so a small amount of investment in a short amount of time into that group, it's a multiplying effect. And so that's kind of where I suppose I am in terms of my vocation, is trying to make a leveraged investment, if you will, in the next generation of faith leaders in, you know, Orlando and beyond. So I think that's kind of where I am, if that makes sense. And then, you know, trying to be a good dad and good husband, frankly, through all of that.
How are you trying to change the world?
You know, I'm in my 40s now, and that answer is probably different than when I was in my 20s. As you realize your own limitations, and that the defining world probably changes.
Yep.
And I think in a healthy way, in what I believe God has called me to do, my goal is to impact the people that have been put in my relationship network in my church, to make them experience God more fully, and to have the fullness of life that they can have. And so, I mean, it's actually a relatively small scope, I suppose. But just realizing that I'm going to try to impact the people around me. And I don't know if that's an underwhelming goal.
But no. Well, no, because sometimes I think we assume we're going to have these big old hairy audacious goals, which I don't think is necessarily the case. But then if you even just look at the leverage and multiplication that you actually can have sitting where you're sitting, it's pretty significant. If more of us would take our roles that serious, the better we would, you know, would be in this world as it exists.
Yeah. I mean, I guess fundamentally trying to serve others, to make them better, which is kind of oddly enough, it kind of comes back around. That's kind of the consultant when done well, that's kind of the consultant mindset. I know consultants lately have a bad rep, but
yeah.
And even private equity in a certain sense, to go back to that, that is to do it well, it requires a servant's heart, because it's not about me fundamentally. I had to fight against that, of course, but
you know, when did you realize the power of capital, and what does that mean to you? That's kind of one question. And then if you have any thoughts that are different from that, given your role, given, you know, your expertise in the New Testament, any thoughts from that perspective will be interesting. So when did you realize the power of capital, and what does that mean to you?
The two angles I think are quite interesting, because, you know, maybe some people who are listening, when they hear you have a theologian on, they're probably rolling their eyes, because money and church haven't historically gone well together. And it's immensely awkward to talk about money in a church context, because you either have the kind of high rolling TV preacher who's trying to raise money for his private jet or something like that. Right. So that's kind of the misconception. So it is kind of an interesting thing to think about. In the kind of private sector, I grew up very rural. My parents were first generation educated in their whole family. My dad picked cotton literally as a kid. And so I had a very adversarial relationship to money probably growing up. And I don't think my parents kind of poor mouthed all the time, but I definitely felt our low middle classness, if you will. And so I always had this weird relationship to money, I think, growing up. And then I get into the business world, and I'm surrounded by people who have tremendous means. And that was a very new experience for me. And as a 21-year-old or whatever, it was rather disorienting. And so I continued, I think, to have this tug of war of, okay, I kind of grew up rural, broke, middle of nowhere, North Carolina. Now I'm surrounded by people who, I'm like flying first class. I'm like, right, this is crazy. I would like, if my parents could see me now, or my grandparents, it was like, I'm flying first class to go consult for Siemens Med. Like, that was wild. And we're going to eat at Morton's five times this week. Like, it was a crazy kind of experience for someone like me. And so again, being surrounded by, you know, partners and very wealthy CEO type people, it was someone like me from Advance in the broke South. It was a very strange thing. So I was surrounded by money and capital early on in my career, and I still had very mixed feelings about it. Although I was finally starting, you know, I was able to make it a decent living at the time, but not, you know, I wasn't, wouldn't be similar. I wasn't like capital wealthy at that stage. And for me, a big turning point happens when I actually made the transition to go into ministry, and we had to raise money for me to go study at Cambridge because it's very expensive and there's not scholarship money much these days and so on. So anyway, I started reaching out to private people who were friends of mine and saying, hey, family's going to go do this. What do you think? Would you be interested in potentially helping us do this? And like thinking the answer was going to just be a hard pass from everybody. Who's going to do this? It's not even tax deferred or tax advantageous. Mm-hmm. And I remember actually it was the first person who said, hey, we want to help you, was my boss at the private equity firm. And mm-hmm. and I had left because I did my master's degree. He called me up for other reasons, said, hey, what you up to? I said, well, actually, you know, in a few months we're flying to Cambridge and here's the next big adventure. And he, like, without me even asking, he said, well, we would love to support you. How about X amount? And it was a pretty decent amount for me. And it blew me away. And then I had all these conversations that summer. And what I discovered is that there are a lot of people who have, and this was a new experience for me. This is where it all comes back together. There are a lot of people out there who are blessed with financial resources and actually want to use them for good. I didn't really have that framework until that point because I was just surrounded by people who had 15,000 square foot houses and the private plane, all that kind of stuff in my business world. And he was like, no, we believe in what you're doing and we want to cut a pretty decent sized check to make it happen. And that blew me away because up until then, I had such negative feelings towards people who had wealth, if you will. And this is a whole different paradigm for me. And just having conversation after conversation with doctors and lawyers and business people and so forth, who they happen to be in a faith community that I was a part of. But either way, they were wanting to be generous. And that completely rocked my world. And so I was actually, what impacts me today more than anything was that experience of, wow, I have been personally blessed by men and women who have this strange ability to cut like a $10,000 check and use it for good and bless people or more than that, whatever it is, and not just use it selfishly, which was my grid, I think, growing up. And so that really shook me in terms of, wow, there is a positive way that capital can be used. And there are people out there wanting to use their resources that way and not just accumulate more stuff. And I was a personal beneficiary of that. So that was really game changing for me.
So what about if you were, I don't know, teaching a class, let's just say, is there anything that you would share with your students around this idea of capital, the power of capital, responsibility from a theological or teaching perspective?
Well, there's probably two halves of it. And I'll do the second half. There's a kind of practical side. And then I'll get to the kind of more theoretical side. On the practical side, most people who are in my shoes, I mean, it's kind of, with the exception of the big name people who frankly give us all a bad reputation because they are, you know, fabulously wealthy and flaunted right. And so forth on TV. Most people who are in any sort of faith-based ministry, and this isn't just limited to Christianity, it's not a high-paying profession, you know, and with rare exception are people even frankly financially stable, let alone prospering. I mean, they're hoping to make rent, if you will. And so most of my students have a very awkward relationship to money because they know what they're signing up for, and there's not going to be a lot of it. And the thing I think I've learned, and not only from that experience that I just outlined, but even in my time since, like with the NCF or what have you, and just rubbing shoulders with people in the community who are generous in a way that's truly admirable, is what I'd want to try to help my students grasp is how to interact with those kinds of people and not make it weird and not make it awkward. The more I go to donor dinners and that kind of thing, the less I'm uncomfortable with the ask. Whereas I used to be like, I can never do that, because I realized, no, these people actually want to be useful. They've been blessed. They realize the privilege and the obligation that comes with that. And yes, they're well taken care of. And yes, there's lots of benefits that come to that materially, but they also want to be useful. And sometimes you just got to ask, and you got to make a compelling case for why this matters and why we want you to partner with us in this. And I think there's a whole world of like helping people know how to navigate that. And this is not probably just a ministry thing. This could be any sort of 501c3 thing, like to be bold in asking and making, like being very clear about the objectives of what you're asking for and not being shy about it, because there are actually just a lot of generous people who actually have a good heart and want to be useful with the resources they have. So that's kind of the practical side, sort of a how-to. On the theoretical side, there's a funny way, and then just speaking from my own experience with the Bible, Old and New Testament, although the Quran says similar things, our scriptural texts have a remarkably complex way of approaching money. And just taking Jesus, for example, on the one hand, his whole ministry was bankrolled by very generous people. And Luke's gospel in particular mentions he has a group of women, one of whom was essentially the estate manager's wife for the king of the area, Herod's household manager. Her name was Joanna. And she's helping personally finance, Jesus and the apostles, and they're traveling around. They need to eat and they need to stay somewhere and so on. There's a whole other group of women. You also have different people who are named in the New Testament in particular who appear to have wealth because they host churches in their home and they're well known. They're called benefactors or they're called patrons. One's named Phoebe in Romans. And so that's very fascinating that there's nothing shy about. The Bible is remarkably not shy about money and about giving. And in fact, the Apostle Paul, as some of the listeners might be aware of, he's a famous apostle, and a huge part of his ministry was raising money. A lot of people don't realize that because he's going around, he's picking fights with people, he's theologizing, writing these important documents, but also he's raising money. And he's not shy about it. He's basically like, hey, I want to put some pressure on you to match what these other folks are. He's like the first one to do a kind of matching gift, at least verbally, where he's like, hey, these other folks are giving. And are you Corinthians, are you interested in getting in on this? And I just got to make sure that you're kind of putting your money where your mouth is. Like, it's quite interesting what he does. He does not bat an eyelash about, hey, we need to raise money. Here's why. And this is a guy that I'm sending you to collect this money. And he's legit and he's trustworthy. He's not going to steal your money. So he gets into all that kind of stuff. And you kind of have to read his letters from that angle to see that kind of stuff. So there's the positive side. That being said, Jesus also very famously has some very harsh things to say about wealth and some very difficult things to say about wealth. And he often uses foolish, wealthy people who are assuming that they're just going to keep kicking butt. He doesn't use that terminology, of course. they're just going to keep crushing it and building better, bigger and better barns. And then they die, right, in this parable. And all of their foolish, selfish gain was for nothing. Or it's harder for a rich person to enter heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. He says very difficult things, too. So it's very sobering, actually, to try to handle money well in a church context or any kind of context, because I think what the New Testament is getting at is there's tremendous blessings, which I would argue ultimately come from God through wealth, but there's also massive risks that we all, I think, no matter how much money you have to kind of navigate that as well. You can be a greedy wealthy person, you can be a greedy poor person, and so it's just for me, there's a lot of nuance and a lot of complexity that unfortunately is missed in broader faith communities, because either you have very bad examples of, again, people trying to raise money for their private jet because God told them to, or people who just can't talk about money in any sort of way without it getting super awkward. And there's got to be some space to actually be pretty honest with the text. And I think it's just fascinating to me to kind of navigate it now.
Well, what's interesting to me is take the faith out of it for a second. All you got to do is look around in the world that we live in, and you can see wonderful examples of wealth being used in an extremely positive way. And unfortunately, we see plenty of examples where wealth is destructive, whether it's destructive personally, whether it's to their family lineage. And so, again, regardless of where people fall, there just seems like there's legitimate truth in that message, that it is money is a a powerful and dangerous tool all in one, which is really where I think impact investing is this acknowledgement. I mean, on one hand, you could say it's, especially if you're excluding stuff from your investing, you're like, I don't want to be a part of that. On the other hand, you're saying, we want to be deliberate about investing in things that align with our value set. And it forces you to be in a position of open-handedness because you're risking capital for the sake of others. And it requires a different mindset than it's all about me. It's all about my return. And so I actually think one of the ways you safeguard against greed and fear and frankly, normal investing emotions is when you start to go, no, does it align with my value system and how is it impacting others? And it changes it. And you start to go, oh, I actually can start to experience some joy, some freedom, and that greed and fear can actually melt away a little bit. So whether you have a faith or not, it's hard to argue against the reality and truth of these simple things we're talking about.
Yeah.
So switching, and I think it's the other side of the coin or part of the coin or whatever. Just curious your thoughts on what stewardship means to you.
I think stewardship, for me at least, is you have been given something. And again, for me, that's by the creator. But even if not for you, for a certain listener, it could be something else, right? Your ancestors, your parents, what have you, your workplace. So say a deposit of something, and this could be time, this could be ability, this could be, you know, material wealth, and it's been entrusted to you. And so stewardship is, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to use it to bless society and your family and others, or are you going to squander it on your own sort of short-term gain? I think gain. So I think fundamentally stewardship, or good stewardship, is making wise use of the things that you have been given that are at your disposal. And then there can be bad stewardship, which is blowing it all on something that is foolish. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really that simple, fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, okay, well, what are the ways in which you decide what those good things are? But that's a different issue, you know. But that thing fundamentally is like trying to make good use of and beneficial use of whatever kind of resources you want to talk about. They could be capital, they could be other things.
Put on your theologian hat. Why do you think we're called to be good stewards?
You know, if you consider the three Abrahamic religions, at least Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, I think what connects them all is this notion that there is a creator, and that creator has made humans, in all things, but humans in particular, with a certain massive amount of dignity in his own image, bestowed upon us this obligation to take care of creation, to take care of each other, and to make the earth fruitful and to bring good out of it. And so the goal then is to do that, basically to implement what we call the creation mandate. And that impacts how you use resources in the natural world, how you build communities, how you build families, education, all those kinds of things. So all that, for me at least, is part of what has been imprinted upon us as humans by a creator, I think fundamentally is what it is. And of course, you know, each world faith will depart in a lot of the specifics. But at least if they're to the degree that they're united by this basic principle of there is something special about humans, there is a direction things are all heading, and that direction isn't determined by random genetic mutations, but it is actually determined by a sovereign God with humanity's good in mind, then that is the motivating factor. I would have a hard time, frankly, figuring out what that goal would be if I were, as an example, someone who just believed in kind of the forces of macroevolution. There is a way to articulate it, but for me, at least as a person of faith, I would have a hard time kind of sorting that out. As opposed, why not just sort of keep it all for myself? But if you are motivated by, no, there is a greater good, a greater purpose, a greater direction that's all heading than that, that causes your priorities to fall into a certain kind of a certain direction, if you will.
All right, so I'm going to ask you one other quick question that you may agree or disagree, but my experience has been, when we talk about, and I'm going to isolate to the faith community, mm-hmm. when we talk about impact investing, other terms will be put on like faith aligned investing, faith-based investing. Generally, if I had to stereotype, when it comes to environmental stewardship, in my terminology, in the faith community, it's a notch below other things, or maybe it's not a priority. Right. And I have my own opinions. Do you hear that? Why do you think that is? Or am I just, you think this is just unique to my experience?
No, I definitely don't think that's unique to your experience. And I do think environmental stewardship is kind of maybe it's less divisive now because there's so many other divisive things. It's not because it's less divisive, but because it just gets shouted out more. But yeah, I've noticed certainly since the sort of 2000s and onward that Christians are many churches and Christians are uneasy about environmental stewardship. And I think there's probably two reasons for that. One perhaps is kind of the more theologically consistent one, and one is my more cynical reason. And the theologically consistent one would be if you hold to a certain view of where things are headed, and if you kind of buy into this notion that, you know, it's all going to burn, it's all going to end in this massive kind of catastrophe and be remade, then you might say, well, then if that's true, if it's all going to burn, as people are wont to say, then why care that much? Mm-hmm. We might as well just strip the earth of its resources and not worry about any implications, because it's all going to burn anyways. All going to go to hell in a handbasket anyways, as, you know, kind of old school folks might say. The sort of more cynical reason is, I think environmental stewardship sounds or it sounds more like a kind of left wing progressive agenda item, and therefore a lot of folks would be disinterested in that for the political reasons. I don't think that's a fair conclusion, but I think that's a conclusion a lot of people make. I think you can make a very compelling case, and it certainly has been made. There are pockets of Christians and Jews and others as well who do actually think that simultaneously, yes, the world is heading towards some sort of grand remaking, and our hope is fundamentally in a heavenly remaking of all things. Yeah, but there is still an obligation to take care of what we have, and that doesn't have to be a kind of a purely leftist kind of thing. Again, if someone wants to sort of overlay the political lens on it,
sure,
that you can make a case that biblically or otherwise, it is a wise act of stewardship to care for creation, because it impacts quality of life of people. It impacts those who we are called in Scripture to care for, the poor and the downtrodden, and those who are often disproportionately impacted by bad environmental stewardship. And that's not a political talking point. That's just a thing, right? And so I think there are pockets of Christians who do care about the environment. They're probably not as vocal as one might want them to be, but I think there definitely is space to have healthy conversations and to not just like close down the discussion because it sounds sort of overtly political. I think there actually needs to be more conversation in that respect and more nuanced thinking about, you know, what are we saying, what are we not saying, and you don't want to be overly alarmist, but you also want to be responsible and sober about what is happening and how to help. So yeah, that's kind of where I stand on it, at least.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think in the faith community, when you're talking about environmental issues, a lot of people view that environmental issue as a religion in and of itself. And so therefore, if I'm supporting that, the earth is somehow more important than a creator. And I think there's this fear like, oh, that just you're going to elevate one versus the other. But I actually would say, I think a lot of the faith community, it's like you're missing the boat that to all the reasons you said, we need to be stewards. This does impact people's lives. So yeah, it's just an interesting phenomenon that I've experienced and would hope that more, and that's not to say that clearly there are people of faith who do care, but I wish actually more would.
Yeah.
Because I also think it's meeting people where they're at and, locking arms with more people about things that we care about and together, I think is what we need to be doing. So the last question, and this is a really broad question, and I'm unless you want to insert your family, I'm going to say leave your family out of this question, but I'll give you freedom if you can't do that. If you could make one dream come true for your life, what would it be? And to clarify, it doesn't have to be the biggest dream, but just a dream that you'd like to have happen.
And you've eliminated the family
Go ahead.
side.
If you want to say the family, you can, but then I'm gonna ask you for something outside of the family too.
Okay, so well, fine. If you're gonna take the family off of it, I might as well just deal with something else then. And this doesn't have to be like a big kind of TED Talk kind of dream. This could
No,
be.
it just it, you get to the end of your life, and if you could go, man, that actually happened, and whatever it is.
It's interesting. I don't know. I feel like a lot of it has.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I got to live in England. I got to live in Cambridge. That was actually the PhD process was not fun, but living there was actually really cool. It was great. I mean, it was a great time involving other humans that I'm have a special relationship with. I'm not allowed to say family. But yeah, I mean, got to see cool things, and I mean that really was a an unanticipated bucket list item, I suppose, in my life. I'd love to get to the. I haven't been able to go to the Holy Lands, of course. As
Okay.
a Bible nerd, that would be on the list. Ultimately, and this is going to sound super spiritual, and I don't really intend it that way, but I suppose. The most important dream, I guess, that I do try to take seriously, and it shapes the way I think about, okay, what am I going to focus on in terms of the books I write, and how am I going to think about success? Because I could say, I'd love to write the book that gets 10,000 reviews on
Yep.
Amazon and sets us up for life and makes me more than Chick-fil-A money. Although, yeah, it'd be great to even make Chick-fil-A money these days, from the books I sell, but so I have to really watch against those kinds of aspirations and getting them disordered and wanting to be a best-selling author, a big deal, and be invited to all the stuff. One way I try to control for that, it really is a simple kind of New Testament principle, which is my dream is I get to the end and the word that is said by my creator is well done. And that's enough, I think, fundamentally, which is not my thoughts. That's from the Bible. But yeah, I think that is. And that of course involves well done in terms of family, well done husband, well done teacher, pastor, neighbor. But I think that's the goal, and that could be small, it could be big, in terms of what that means. But for me, that's I think the goal. And I just appreciate the work you're doing and the conversations you're having. So thanks for kind of taking a having a, an idea to have me on. It's kind of a unusual, I suppose. So.
Well, you'll have to share this with your students. See if there's let them be the critics of this.
Yeah.
But don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. Until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.